Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel. Crossland, Corsa and Mokka. Three good reasons to visit the Opel Open Road event.
This morning, 100 years ago, a Sinn Féin delegation in London signed the 18-article Anglo-Irish Treaty. It was a momentous decision, and in making it, the signatories not only formally reached an historic Anglo-Irish compromise, but also set the scene for a fatal division of the Irish Republican movement. Dermot Ferriter, Professor of Modern Irish History at UCD, joins me now to discuss this. Much has been said and written about this moment 100 years ago. We're going to talk about the aftermath. And do you feel that conflict was inevitable once the names were on paper?
There are very striking photographs of grave-faced politicians in London 100 years ago.
I was looking at them this morning.
You could see them. You could see the pressure that they were under, and they're caught in the light of the flashbulbs. But think about those who are waiting at home. For all of the focus on the negotiators and how important those politicians were, think about those who are waiting. On paper, there were 112,650 members of the IRA in Ireland at that time. There were thousands of Common Man members. They were waiting to see what would transpire. Many of them, perhaps we could say, had unrealistic expectations about what might transpire in London. But we have to start thinking about them and how they dealt with the news as it came out. And over the course of the couple of days after the signing of the treaty, there would have been widespread, obviously, press coverage about the contents of the treaty. Some of them were horrified at what they regarded as a great betrayal. And there are very telling moments during the treaty debates where politicians and soldiers, and remember, many of them were two sides of the same coin. Cathal Brua makes reference to the men who count. And he's talking, of course, about the IRA. What will they make of that? Historians estimate that over 70% of the IRA were opposed to the treaty. About 12,000 Common Man members anti-treaty. So when you consider that, some form of conflict, I think, was inevitable. There were also many soldiers who believed that they had brought the Republic into being and it wasn't for politicians to give it away. And that might be a simplistic narrative, the idea that they gave away the Republic in London because it was never on offer in the first place. But that was a very strongly held view. So when you consider that, some form of conflict was inevitable. There were also those, including Liam Lynch, who was later to assert that it was up to soldiers to hew the way to freedom for politicians to follow. So again, you can get that sense of the concerns about the balance between the military perspective and the political perspective. But we should acknowledge there were various attempts to bring both sides together. Mm-hmm. The first 6 months of 1922, they're fraught, but there are various attempts to try and maintain army mutiny. And even both sides of the treaty divide after the Dáil vote in January. They meet in February again in the Mansion House. They agree to postpone elections. And again, the primary preoccupation is keeping army mutiny. Army unity. So when you consider those impulses at work in the first few months, you could say there were valiant attempts made to try and prevent conflict. But ultimately, those who had dug their heels in by February and March 1922 were going to become more entrenched.
Can we indulge in a bit of whataboutery now? Because just reading all this stuff over the weekend, the controversy around De Valera, the description by some historians as, you know, Why wasn't he in London? It was mystifying that he wasn't there. Had he been in London, would the outcome have been any different?
It could have been. But you could argue that it was unlikely. He had been over in London in July. He had met David Lloyd George one-on-one before the formal negotiations began in October. He knew what was on offer. He knew the limitations. What he was trying to do was ride two horses. I mean, he was trying to be involved in negotiations, but he remained in Dublin. And there was an arrogance to that, you could argue. He was also still trying to work out how he could persuade the more hardline to accept the idea of a compromise, something that was less than the Republic. But ultimately, De Valera would not have been able to achieve a Republic. And I don't think he would have given more attention to the Ulster question either, because even when he offered his alternative to the treaty, the so-called document number two, he wasn't suggesting anything radically different in relation to the Ulster question. So that issue would have remained unresolved. But you could argue that as a more experienced politician, and one who was so fastidious with words and phrases that he would have been much more careful than the other negotiators about the way particular clauses of the treaty were phrased, and perhaps not given as many hostages to fortune.
Or perhaps he knew there was going to have to be a compromise. He knew that, he could see it coming, and so it suited him to be in Ireland and away from it.
That's a very valid argument, and it's an argument that has been made. And you can see that anger coming out during the treaty debates as well, when Arthur Griffith and Collins in particular challenge him, because he sent them over with plenipotentiary powers. He sent them over to do their utmost for Ireland, which they were able to say during the treaty debates they had done.
Yeah, I just, Bertie Ahern was writing about this in May of this year, and he said, "I, as Taoiseach, never for a second countenance staying away from the negotiations that resulted in the Good Friday Agreement." And he says, "Given my strong Fianna Fáil background, people may be surprised to read that I think Dev was wrong not to lead the Irish delegation at the treaty talks."
At the time, Robert Barton, who of course was a very reluctant signatory of the treaty, he accepted the logic of what De Valera was doing. He thought it was wise to keep De Valera in Dublin, the symbol of the Republic, if he needed to be called upon as a kind of a court of appeal or as a final court of appeal, to have that authority figure not tainted by what De Valera referred to as the London atmosphere. And that phrase, the London atmosphere, is loaded when you consider what was involved and the strain on these people. And Robert Barton accepted that, but he did say, he added a barb, that by the end, that was the time for De Valera to come over. In other words, he didn't need to be there for the whole of the negotiations, but he should have come over at a late stage, because that would have given the Irish delegation perhaps more authority and more force.
So he could have perhaps squeezed more concessions had he come in at the last minute.
Yeah, and you know, we've heard that argument as well, that they could have gone on, you know, that De Valera strategically perhaps would have tried to drag them out further. And that brings you back to whether this pressure that's applied and this threat of war was a bluff or not.
Let's go back then to the signatories and the photograph that we were talking about earlier with the glum faces around the table. What became of them afterwards?
Well, they had every reason to be glum. And you see, that's the thing when you trace their afterlives. I mean, obviously, the highest profile casualty of the Civil War was Michael Collins. Arthur Griffith, too, died in August 1922, completely exhausted. His friend Con Curran said at the time that he had died with his work done, that Arthur Griffith had lived to see a new state come into being, a parliament in Dublin. This is what he had always wanted. There are very few politicians you can actually say that about, and we should think about Griffith in relation to what he achieved and what he realised in his lifetime. But he was exhausted and disappointed, and he was going back and forward from Dublin to London in the months after the treaty.
We've spoken about this before. They were exhausted going into
talks. Yeah, they were exhausted. But, you know, so Griffith and Collins are obviously dead by August 1922. Charles Gavan Duffy really struggled after he had signed the treaty. He said during the treaty debates that my heart is against this treaty, but you, if you're opposing the treaty, have to come up with a credible and rational alternative. It's not enough just to oppose it. It's not enough just to speak from the heart. And he was appointed Minister for Foreign Affairs, but he didn't last, you know, in that pro-treaty government, because he couldn't reconcile his own views with the decisions that the government were making, particularly during the Civil War and the executions and the winding up of the Dáil courts. And he ended up drifting back into the law. He eventually became a High Court judge and a renowned High Court judge. He died in the early 1950s. Robert Barton lived the longest of any of them. He's alive in 1975. He doesn't die until 1975. But again, Barton finds himself voting for the treaty and then joins the barricades with the anti-treatyites at the Hammond Hotel in 1922. And then he again drifts out of politics after 1923, very sympathetic to Fianna Fáil. He was somebody who became involved in the Irish Press Group, for example, so very strong Fianna Fáil sympathies. Eamon Duggan stayed in pro-treaty politics in the 1930s. He's kind of like a floating junior minister across a whole range of different portfolios. But he drifts out of politics. He is elected to the Senate in 1933, but he's dead by 1936. So that's what happened to the five signatories.
Mm-hmm. And did it lay the foundations then, when you're looking at the relationship between the Anglo-Irish relations in the aftermath of the signing of the treaty? It was Griffith who said, "This will lay the foundations of peace and friendship." Did it?
Yeah, a lot of the work that was done in the 1920s was done through the imperial conferences. So, you know, the Free State cooperated with other dominions to try and increase the autonomy of the dominions. And they were successful in doing that. By 1931, the dominions have autonomy. So people like Desmond Fitzgerald, the first minister for external affairs, and Patrick McGilligan later worked those imperial conferences. And there are fraught moments, obviously, in relation to Irish citizenship. There are moments of tension. But the real concern on the part of the British government is what a change of government might mean, as happens in 1932, about whether they can work with Éamon de Valera. As it turns out, they can. And you can imagine how difficult it must have been for supporters of the treaty to watch de Valera then come in and rip the treaty to shreds. Mm-hmm. And getting rid of the hated oath of allegiance of the Governor General. You have, of course, the return of the ports in 1938, allowing neutrality. So in that sense, he vindicated the assertion of those who supported the treaty that it could be a stepping stone to achieving what you wanted to achieve. That was very difficult for his political opponents to stomach. And even as early as 1927, Fianna Fáil do come into the Dáil. They take the oath of allegiance because they have to if they're going to have a political future. So, you know, there were obviously reasons why, for so many, de Valera was somebody they just could not forgive. Why was, in 1927, the oath an empty formula when it wasn't that in 1922, had it been worth the Civil War? They kept coming back to that. And even when you look at how they remembered the treaty for the significant anniversaries, the 25th anniversary, Fianna Fáil won't go near it. They're in power. Fine Gael end up going to the Mansion House to commemorate it in 1941. And Richard Mulcahy talks about how the treaty won Ireland back its purse and gave Ireland a sovereignty that was developed. And the 50th anniversary of 1971, you can still see the tension because Jack Lynch's Taoiseach is on the receiving end of castigation from Richie Ryan, who referred to Lynch's pygmy-minded pettiness in not marking the 50th anniversary of the treaty. A formal commemoration of the treaty was seen very much as a Fine Gael affair.
But you could argue the same today, couldn't you?
Well, this is the thing about who remembers it and who is most vocal about it. I suppose at this juncture, we're wary of simple dichotomies. You know, that you can't just bunch that generation or that group of Sinn Féiners into pro-treaty and anti-treaty. There were many who wavered in between. And going back again to the grassroots, those who were struggling to make a decision about this, there were those who decided it wasn't worth a civil war. There were those who opted out of the subsequent civil war and who were very concerned, obviously, with getting on with life. You know, at the 50th anniversary of the treaty, the historian Leland Lyons wrote about the danger of people becoming prisoners of ideology. Many people were not preoccupied with abstract dogma. They wanted to get on with things. They wanted the peace to continue. They wanted to get back and make the transition, I suppose, from their revolutionary selves to their civilian selves.
I want to go back to the Boundary Commission because that was held up, wasn't it, as something that could deliver for nationalists. What came of it?
Oh, they felt very betrayed. You know, you can read very disappointed Belfast volunteers, IRA volunteers, looking back in the 1930s about how they had to drift back into this contested state, this new state of Northern Ireland. There's a very telling phrase used by Ciar Healy, who was a leading Ulster Sinn Féiner and MP, and he said that we got no light or leading from Dublin, and they didn't understand the northern situation or the northern mind. So that sense of unfinished business and abandonment is very strong. And when it comes to the Boundary Commission, as Ciar Healy saw it, that just solidified the sense of betrayal. We've been sold into political servitude, he asserted.
What did they expect and what did they get?
Well, what they hoped, of course, was that there would be an opportunity for them to choose whether they wanted to be part of the Free State or remain in Northern Ireland. And particularly when you look at Fermanagh and Tyrone, of course, which were nationalist majority counties, there was a belief that if they got an opportunity, the people of those counties, to vote on this, that they would choose to go in to the Free State. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, there was no provision in the treaty for that vote. There was talk of possible plebiscites. But of course, The phrase relating to the Boundary Commission, the treaty, was deliberately vague. If it hadn't been vague, it wouldn't got into the text of the treaty in the first place.
You're going back all the time, though, aren't you, to the lack of experience around the table on the Irish side to allow that to happen. And I come back to it again. Had he been there, would he have allowed that to go
They were
ahead?
Hoodwinked. I think he would have been more careful about the phrasing when it came to the Boundary Commission. I mean, I don't think he would have had more advanced ideas other than the opportunity for those affected by the border to be able to have a say. But he would have looked, I think, much more closely at the wording. But you've also got to remember, De Valera didn't have the Ulster policy for that Sinn Féin delegation worked out before they left. So they were getting it quite late. Mm-hmm. You can see the correspondence between himself and Griffith about what that'll mean in practice in relation to the negotiations. But there's very little mention of James Craig, who is not going to budge. He has his new state of Northern Ireland. So that has to be factored in as well. And there's no reason to believe that De Valera was going to make any more progress with James Craig than the others. Indeed, James Craig found Eamon De Valera intensely irritating, and he found Michael Collins easier to deal with. But then Michael Collins was speaking out of both sides of his mouth after the treaty, and that he was secretly authorising IRA incursions into the new Northern Ireland to try and destabilise it. Whilst at the same time, in his talks with James Craig, he was emphasising the need for peace and resolution. So there is skullduggery going on there, and there are shadow language and mm-hmm. shape-shifting in those months after the signing of the treaty.
You touched on the nuance that we should have around commemoration now that wasn't there at 25 and at 50. Are we there, do you think?
Well, you see, the context changed all the time, because at the time of the 50th anniversary, people were dealing with the onslaught of the Troubles. And there was a lot of focus on the idea of not coming under the sway of ideology mm-hmm. and fundamentalism once again. So that was that context there. By the time of the 75th anniversary, there was a lot of praise for the pro-treaty side from a lot of historians and political scientists, the idea that the realistic moderates had triumphed and that that was good for the state. But there was a bit of a hero and villain school of interpretation, whereas we have a much stronger sense 100 years on of the emotional turmoil that was experienced by people as well as the politics of this, that we can't just box them in, that we have to allow their 1922 selves to breathe. And I was reading the memoir of Liam O'Brien there recently, who was an Irish language activist who was imprisoned as an IRA member during the War of Independence. And when he was looking back and writing his memoir, he wrote, 1922 left me a permanently disappointed man. And we do have to appreciate that sense of disappointment and unfinished business, but also ultimately that those who predicted that this would be the beginnings of the maximising of sovereignty for the southern state were vindicated. What neither side of the treaty divide achieved, of course, was a 32-county republic. And that still has not been achieved.
I went to see the treaty by Colin Murphy, which was on at the National Concert Hall, which goes through the negotiations. And really, you get the sense of nuance, the agonising, the difficulties, even the lack of, I mean, we forget sometimes, they didn't have the technological ability to communicate with Dublin. Those journeys back and forth were so arduous. It's no wonder, really, that we ended up where we did at this moment 100 years ago.
When we consider the limits on not just communication, but also of breaking out of the straitjacket that was a part of Sinn Féin in 1921, by which I mean they had committed themselves mm-hmm. to a republic. They were oath-bound to try and achieve that republic. So whatever about communications difficulties, the real problem for Sinn Féin was how to break out of that straitjacket okay. and how to persuade people that this had to be a long-term ambition as opposed to something that could be realised in 1921.
Dearest Farrator, thank you very much indeed for coming in. That's